My guest today is theologian Harvey Cox. He's a professor at the Harvard Divinity School and the author of 8 books, including The Secular City, now widely reprinted and translated. His new book, Many Mansions, tells of his experiences establishing dialogues with people of many different faiths and the influences of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and Judaism on his own theological ideas. Harvey Cox's curiosity about other religions is part of a personal faith journey that became widely known with the publication of The Secular City in 1965. Almost 25 years ago, when The Secular City was published, Cox saw that increasing urban civilization and consumerism were linked to the collapse of traditional religion. But there's been a lot of change since then. The rise of fundamentalist religions, the increase of political power amongst religious groups, and the growing holistic back-to-the-earth movements. I wondered what provoked the changes since he wrote The Secular City.
Well, certainly many of the predictions that were made back there 20 to 25 years ago about the future of religion turned out to be mistaken. Most observers were forecasting that religion in one way or another would become more marginal or more peripheral to the modern urban world. It would certainly continue as a personal dimension of life, but I think what was not foreseen was this rather remarkable resurgence of religion in the public sphere, in political life and things of that nature. I think one of the things that's happened, perhaps the single most important thing that's brought this about, is a certain kind of disappearance of the bloom from the rose of the promise of science and technology and progress and all of that. Already, even 25 years ago, there were some seeds of doubt, but in the last 25 years, that I think we just have to say that the promise of scientific technology appears to have been oversold. And now we are living with some of the fallout, literally and symbolically, of that overestimate. And people are beginning to look around for other frames of references, other sources of meaning, other kinds of values that give their lives some shape. And consequently, this rather remarkable reappropriation, you might say, of traditional religious beliefs and practices, which just was not anticipated 25 years ago.
And which
hardly anyone.
Which has curiously led to increasing conflict between fundamentalists and religious groups, between Muslim and Christians, between Jews and
Christians,
Hindus and Muslims.
Yeah, it's paradoxical in a way. On the one hand, we have more harmony and dialogue going on among religious groups who were more antagonistic in some ways 25 years ago. For example, the relationship between Catholics and Protestants at some levels, or the relationship between Christians and Jews, which is, I think, improved to a great extent, and one could name other kinds of areas of more harmonious interaction. And at the same time, we have deepened conflict in other places, sometimes among the same groups or other groups, and internal conflicts within the various religious groups, between, on the one hand, those who want to be more open and more pluralistic, and those who are moving toward a more fundamentalist and narrower construction of what their traditions mean. It's a very, very mixed and confused picture, but I think it's made more volatile by the fact that religion is playing a more singular and more important role in the public area. That's where the conflicts go on. If it were contained within the private area of personal and family life, there wouldn't be as much conflict. But when it, as it begins to get into the public area, as it has, then the conflict becomes more evident.
One of the areas that's interested you is that of liberation theology, in particular what's going on in Latin America, how, for instance, the Catholic Church is being involved in political change there. How did you become interested in that dynamic?
Well, many years ago, I wrote a little book that hardly anyone has ever heard of called God's Revolution, and Human Responsibility. And the book was translated into Spanish. Many of my books have been translated into various languages, but that one was translated and was read by some Latin Americans who invited me to visit Latin America. This is now some 20 years ago. And I did. At that time, I didn't know any Spanish. I knew very little about the Latin American continent. And I immediately became very, very attracted, even kind of inspired by what I saw going on there, which was, in effect, a transformation of what had been a very traditional, even kind of feudal, Catholic church into a church which was much more committed to the poor, marginated peoples, to the oppressed and outcast parts of the society, something which also had not been anticipated 25 years ago. It almost proved to me that a whole church can undergo what is something very close to a conversion. So I went back a couple years later and spent the summer learning Spanish and traveled around a good deal and have continued to be in touch. In fact, this has become one of the major areas of my research. I now teach courses here at Harvard on Latin American theology, on liberation theology, and I keep rather closely in touch with it. It has also become one of the most important segments of the worldwide Catholic Church, certainly one of the most creative, both spiritually and intellectually.
But also one of the most controversial within the
Church. And one of the most controversial, that's true.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. In your biography, you were talking about the Baptist Church, which is the church in which you were raised, and in particular about the Black Baptist Church at one point, saying that the preaching can become bombastic or overly bent on arousing effects. Still, what is vital about Black worship is that people in the pews bring their entire range of hopes and resentments into the sanctuary, not just some religious segment. And it seems that there you're seeing the kind of power and combination of religion and day-to-day life that's, for instance, enabled preachers such as Jesse Jackson to come into such political power here in this country.
Yeah, that's exactly... That's exactly right, and the Black churches in the United States, even back before there was a United States, when there were Black churches in the period before American independence, the Black churches have never separated out the religious and the spiritual from the other parts of life the way more establishment-oriented churches have. Its life has always been seen as of a piece with religion permeating everything else. So it's not seen as unnatural within a Black church, a Black Baptist or Methodist church, for example, for there to be worship and praise and sermons and prayers and also discussions about local or even larger political and social concerns that are impinging on the life of the congregation. And I think that's a very healthy, holistic view of life. And it's something that all of us have something to learn from, those of us who are not part of that tradition. It's something that the Catholic bishops here in the United States have also picked up on in a way. You remember in the last 5 or 6 years, they have begun issuing pastoral letters about things like nuclear weapons or unemployment and the state of the economy and things
and poverty
like this.
And so on.
Yes. And a lot of people said, well, what are they talking about that kind of stuff for? What does this have to do with religion? When anybody who knows the first thing about the Bible realizes that the Bible itself is about these issues. It's about homelessness and work and disease and conflict and peacemaking and all the rest. So I think they're guiding their churches in a way toward a more holistic view as well. And I see this happening in many different religious traditions. This isn't restricted also only to Christian churches.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. Many of us are aware of Islam and of the practicing Muslims of the world through what has been going on in the Middle East and in Iran. And I think many in this country have a sense of Islam as being a particularly pernicious religion, one that is interested in fomenting violence in the world. Yet in your book, Many Mansions, you talk about a young woman who came to you to apply to be a teaching assistant in your Jesus and Morality class. And she turned out to be Muslim, and that sort of threw you into a quandary. What was the quandary for you?
Well, I remember the day very well. She was a graduate student in comparative religion who had excellent credentials, both in her scholarly work and in her teaching ability, teaching competence. And I just wondered what my students would think if they walked into a discussion section, which I was interviewing people to lead, and found that a Muslim was leading a discussion section on the Gospels. And so it gave me pause for a moment. And then, as you'll notice in the book, I went on to have a very, very important conversation with her, in which she taught me something I suppose I should have known, which is that in the Muslim tradition, Jesus is honored and respected, whereas the history of Christianity does not assign the same kind of place of respect to the Prophet Muhammad. And she pointed out several, even of the Christian classics, like, for example, a whole section in Dante's Inferno, which really paints a terribly negative picture of the Prophet Muhammad. I learned a lot from her. As it turned out, she was not able to stay and be a teaching assistant. I wish she had. She had to return to her country. But it opened for me a door into what an adventure in learning about the history of Islam, which raised a lot of questions about the present image that many people have in their mind of Islam as this rather nasty and violence-prone religion. People who don't know about whole other aspects of Islam and about the gentle, reciprocal, and dialogical side, about the whole Islamic civilization, which was there in the medieval period when our civilization was still quasi-barbaric, and who have to realize that in the long view of things, a lot of the negative side of Islam that we see now is in response to a considerable period of Western Christian dominance of Islamic countries. Islam has become, for many of them, the voice of their own past and of their own dignity, of their own identity and history, against what they see as Western domination. And in the midst of all this, I don't think we should fail to see that Islam is now becoming one of the major religious traditions of the United States. It is no longer a simply foreign tradition. In fact, sometime during this past couple years, the number of Muslims in the United States moved slightly past the number of Jews in the United States, so that it is now it is a religious minority, but a growing one.
Is this mostly through immigration?
Almost entirely through immigration. Mm-hmm. There are some conversions, but almost entirely through immigration from Muslim countries. And the Muslims who come here are almost always enormously interested in having dialogue and in deepening understanding between themselves and their Christian neighbors. And in many places in the country, there have been very productive meetings and conversations that have been sponsored by local mosques and local churches. And my hope is that the experience of religious pluralism, of mutual respect, which these Muslims, who are now our fellow citizens, many of them, increasingly, the experience they have here of a country where religious pluralism works to everyone's advantage will influence the countries in which Islam is a 95% majority, let's say, like in Saudi Arabia or in Iran or in Iraq, to modify their attitudes toward religious minorities in their countries. I think it's a long road and a very big picture, but I'm hopeful.
Well, unfortunately, part of the tradition also is of people who bring a religion with them, is sometimes the battles and disputes come with them as well to a new land.
That often happens too.
Muslim or Sikh or Catholic and Protestant or whatever. There was a time, I think it was in 12th century Spain, about the time of Sabio the Wise, when Christians, Jews, and Muslims were all working and living together. There was a tremendous blooming of art and of music and of a culture at ease with itself. Mm-hmm. Do you see this as perhaps sort of a re-renaissance that we may have sometime in the future, the future of religion?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that period in Spanish history, because I like to study it, and I even went over to Spain a few years ago to familiarize myself with it a little more. Here was this period, just at and before the Christian, what we call the Middle Ages, or the medieval period, in which Christians and Jews and Muslims all lived together in what is now Spain and Portugal, with some tensions among them, but by and large in mutual respect, helping each other in the construction of their mosques and synagogues and cathedrals, borrowing from each other's poetry, being influenced by each other's spirituality. For example, we now know that St. John of the Cross was considerably influenced by Sufi mysticism, which is a branch of a form of Islamic mysticism. Now, what happened, unfortunately, is that the Jews were expelled from Spain, and the Muslims were defeated militarily and also expelled, those who were left. And a form of Christianity became the kind of ideology for uniting the Hispanic peninsula, and therefore it became intolerant and punishing. That golden era was lost.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that it was there, I think, provides us with a wonderful example of how it could happen again in the future.
My guest is theologian Harvey Cox. His new book is called Many Mansions, and the quotation comes from John. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. You see this as the means of saying that there can be many religions and that we can all live in this plurality. Yet further on in that book of John, there's also a line that refers to Jesus being the only way. How are you able to reconcile these in your mind? Certainly one is used by fundamentalist Christians, the other by say, yourself.
Yeah, and isn't it intriguing that both of those verses are found within five or six lines of each other in the same chapter of the same gospel? In fact, this is what motivated me to investigate this whole theme and to write this book, Many Mansions. In Christianity, as in many traditions, many religious traditions, and the Christian tradition is my own, so I can speak of it more, I suppose, more honestly, there's both an inclusivist and universalist dimension and a narrower and more provincial or more, let's say, exclusivist dimension. And these are always in tension with each other. Every religious tradition has its own set of central events and memories, a sacred text. But the great world traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have a vision of the whole, which is not unrelated to this central core of its own. So it's holding these in the kind of dynamic and fruitful tension that I think is what we're called upon to do.
Uh-huh.
Well, what I'm saying in this book is that tolerance is certainly not enough. Tolerance is a kind of a lackadaisical, lazy man's way of looking at this. I'm interested in a far more active interaction and vigorous, robust interaction among religious traditions, rather than just sort of a live and let live attitude.
For instance, your interest in Krishna has appreciated the shown you the feminine aspects of God.
Yes, right. I think each of these traditions has something to learn from one or more of the others, but only if we are completely honest, if we don't kind of dodge the hard and difficult issues that we have to that are there. And I think what I try to do in this book also is to talk about those parts of my experience of dialogue with people from other religions where the going has been very rough, where I've discovered things I really didn't like, and they have discovered things about our tradition that they didn't like. I think facing those kinds of rough edges is a part of real dialogue rather than a kind of a patsy or wimpy way of doing it. So that's all the case that I'm trying to make in this book, and I'm trying to make it very personal. It's not a book about the abstract comparison of Buddhism with Christianity. There are a lot of books like that. This is talking from a very personal point of view, what my experiences have been as I've tried to engage people in these other traditions in very basic kinds of conversation.
A few years ago, you took the telephone out of your house because you found it intrusive. Do you still have your telephone out?
That was a long time ago, Sej. Uh-huh. That was about 20 years ago when before my children reached teenage.
Uh-huh.
By the time they approached their teenage years, the thought of not having a telephone in the house was like moving to the North Pole and living in an igloo. So I lost that one. But for a few years, we didn't have a telephone. That's right.
You've talked about the importance of the nuclear family, but in many ways, I think now we have the extended family around us. And I think you're a prime example of that. You're now in your 50s and have a second family in many ways going now.
Yeah, that's right. I have a little. I'm approaching my 60s. I'll be 60 during this calendar year, and I have a 2.5-year-old boy, who's a great delight and the source of my ever renewed youth, although he tires me out.
You were raised Baptist. Your wife is Jewish. I understand you're raising your son to be Jewish. Is this an easy choice for you? How are you handling this in your family?
No choices are entirely easy. The Jewish law is very specific on this, that a child born of a Jewish mother is Jewish, no matter what happens to him or what he decides to do or be. And I think as the husband and father in such a family, I have a responsibility for making him familiar with that tradition. And so we observe Sabbath at our house. We observe the Jewish holidays. We also observe the Christian holidays as well. And we are trying to, the way we define it is we are raising this child to be Jewish, to be and to understand his Jewishness as a unique way of being Jewish because he's the son of a Christian father, and that makes a difference in the way he interprets and constructs his own faith. Now, we do this day by day and week by week, and it's not an easy choice, but we're now part of a network, a very, very large network, I might say, of parents of mixed marriages, Jewish-Christian marriages, characterized by the common choice that all of these couples have made not to give up their individual traditions. This is the way it used to be done, you know. One would give up on it, often both of them would give up, because the idea of trying to combine these in any way seemed insurmountably difficult. But there are, we think now, hundreds and hundreds of couples who have come to the conclusion that they want to raise their children in what might be called religious dual citizenship, if possible, and who are helping each other, exchanging materials and talking back and forth. And we don't do it with any cocksureness that we know all the answers. We're taking it day by day, but so far things are going very well.
One other question. You went to divinity school, and so I assume some point before that in your life there must have been an experience, a religious experience, a spiritual experience of some kind that told you to follow that route. Was there one particular moment, or was it just something you always felt?
You know, I'm always embarrassed to say this, but I cannot remember a time from my childhood on when I wasn't very, very clear that I wanted to be a minister. I still consider myself to be a minister. I teach in a school in which a large part of what we do is prepare people for ministry in the various churches. So I never underwent one of those classical kind of conversion crises or a voice calling to me in the night or something. I just grew up believing that this was what I was supposed to be, and very, very happy about it, and very glad to respond to it. And it's been something about which I've never had any second thoughts. So I'm sorry to disabuse you of any notions that there was some great calling moment. I know a lot of people have had those, but I just never did.